Hey everyone, thanks for checking out another podcast. I'm really excited today to have Alex Vitale with me. He's a professor at Brooklyn College and he's here to talk with me about defunding the police. He's sort of the person, one of the people who really put this idea out into the world a few years back, wrote a book about it at the end of policing. And now with everything that's been happening around the country, this is a topic of conversation passing across everyone's lips. It's a really important issue right now. There's a lot of confusion. People don't know what that would look like, what it would entail, how it would play out in our society. So Professor Vitale comes in here today and he's going to just give us his vision of what that might look like. We talk about mental health care, the mental health care system, and police officers dealing with mental health care crises. We talk about the drug war. We talk about the type of social programs that would be necessary to implement to reduce the police presence in our society. It's a very fascinating conversation. I really appreciate his time. I know that there's everyone and their mother wants to talk to him right now about these issues. So the fact that he would sit down with me and be gracious enough with his time to spend an afternoon with me, I really appreciate that. If you guys find these useful, please like or subscribe and follow on whatever platform you're listening to these. If you're on the YouTube channel, subscribe. And another thing that would really help is writing a review. That really helps ensure that more people get a hold of this content, which I think is important. So again, thank you very much for your time. I hope you guys find this useful. Now sit back and please enjoy the conversation. Thanks. Hey, thanks again for joining me. I really appreciate the time. I know you have a lot of people who are interested in talking with you, given everything that's happening. And so I just want to jump right into it. And can we just talk a little bit about what policing? So policing now, I think on both sides of this, everyone's sort of saying, wow, they're asked to do things that they're really not qualified to do, they're not trained to do, that it doesn't seem appropriate to a lot of Americans to see officers engaging in a lot of these activities that they're engaging in. Can you talk a little bit about what got us to the point as a society where we have police serving as mental health care providers and, you know, drug treatment specialists with guns? Like, how do we get there?
You bet. So I see it as tied to a kind of politics of austerity. So over the last 40, 50 years, in the face of, you know, growing global competition, free markets kind of stuff, government at all levels has tended to kind of push economic resources up the economic ladder to subsidize the already most successful parts of the economy in hopes that some of that wealth that they generate will magically trickle down to the rest of us. Supply side economics, voodoo economics, whatever you want to call it. Now, that has produced not growing wealth for everyone. It's produced massive economic inequality. And it's also hamstrung the ability of government to do a lot, both financially and ideologically, and I'll talk about that in just a second. So the result of this kind of neoliberal austerity politics has been the growth of mass homelessness, mass untreated mental health and substance abuse problems, failed schools, mass involvement in black markets of drugs and sex work and stolen goods, and then those problems have been turned over to the police to manage. You know, we didn't really have homelessness in the United States before the late 70s and early 80s. So there was no policing of homelessness because there was no homelessness. And the deinstitutionalization and defunding of mental health services created a problem there, right? And so we've created these social problems, made them worse, and then turned them over to police to manage, in part because we can then define these as problems of individual and group moral failure that will only respond to these kinds of coercive and punitive interventions. And then that lets government off the hook for defunding education, defunding public housing, not providing basic economic stability for people.
So it's this deindustrialization that's taken place to benefit a handful of people. And in that process, you've created giant social problems, and because we live in a society where we're able to boil things down to individual culpability, that we're very reliant upon that idea, that concept, it's policing is something that's easily sold to the American. Is that sort of what you're saying as a solution?
Yes, and it's not just that it's easy to sell; it's that it's important to sell it that way, because see, if the problem is individual and group moral failure, then the solution is these punitive and coercive interventions. If, however, the problem of homelessness wasn't moral laxity it was market failure, then government would need to intervene in housing markets. But that goes exactly against the whole neoliberal austerity politics, which says government has to just turn that all over to the free market.
So if these problems are not at an individual level, they're these massive systemic problems that have been generated over long periods of time, largely by the state and the people who control the state, then do you see a slow piecemeal process to address it, or are you, is this something that's going to require like a Marshall Plan in Europe or a New Deal that we had in the United States? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly don't think we're going to fix it with implicit bias training.
Right.
I mean, this is going to require substantial interventions into the root causes, so to speak, of these underlying social problems. Now, that doesn't mean that all we can do is wait until there's some profound change in government and a new deal. You know, there are things we could do tomorrow to reduce crime and disorder, as people normally understand those terms, without relying on police.
Right.
And we should do those things while we work on these larger transformations.
So I want to ask you about some of those things. But before we do that, the big elephant in the room in America today is this word defund the police. Can you talk about what does that mean? People envision that means the police are going to disappear, and then everything's just going to turn to chaos. What is that? And you talk about. Can you just talk about how that looks to an everyday person and put it in every language as somebody who may not study policing?
Well, Thomas, I thought you knew where the magic switch was, that if we could just turn that off, there would be no police tomorrow. But of course, no such switch exists, right?
I
mean, there's no city council out there that's going to zero out the police budget in next year's, budget hearing. So we have this massive policing apparatus. It's in place. And what people are talking about is a very straightforward kind of everyday politics. They're saying, look, cities are spending 25, 35, 40% of their budgets on policing every year while telling the public there's no money for mental health services, there's no money to fix the schools, there's no money for drug treatment. And people are saying, actually, there is money. It's just all going to policing and jails and mass incarceration. And we'd actually like some of those resources shifted into community-identified needs that would directly address the public safety challenges identified by those communities. Now, what is the extent of that transfer? Well, so far, very little, right? It's just chipping away. Maybe we can reduce school policing and hire more counselors. Maybe we can reduce the use of police to do mental health crisis calls and hire some mental health clinicians and outreach workers, But potentially this could lead to bigger interventions, getting police out of the drug business, out of the sex work business, out of the gang suppression business, et cetera.
So let's touch on that. So let's say, so one of the major functions, so when I was a cop, I was constantly frustrated by the drug war, and especially when I was in investigative positions, and I saw that I was trying to investigate a group of people that had been burglarizing houses in the neighborhood, or a crew of armed robbery suspects were going in and putting guns at Circle K clerks, and I would see that I was being pulled to provide resources for these drug investigations. Constantly, it was this huge suck on the department. How do we address it? So, as a society, what are some of the things that we can do to remove that function from policing? Is it just because I don't see tomorrow us turning into Portugal? And what is reasonable and achievable today?
Yeah, that's a separate question, and it is going to be a big lift. I mean, I just take a step back, though, and say, right, no matter what you did, Was there ever 5 minutes that someone couldn't get drugs on your patch?
No, absolutely. Never. It was temporary. Right. It was counterproductive. It was.
Frankly, right. You can look at like Peter Moskos' book, Cop in the Hood, when he was a cop in Baltimore. And he's like, no matter what we did, it just made no difference. And big federal task forces, it just doesn't make any difference. In fact, it makes the problem worse. So how do we get to a better place? Well, strategically, people have focused on marijuana. So these efforts to decriminalize or legalize marijuana, I think, are seen as a first step. For some people, that's the only step, but for other people, they see it as part of a longer trajectory of establishing a logic of harm reduction and a logic of public health interventions and a logic of just leaving people alone for whom these things are not a major problem in their lives, and to dialing back the negative consequences of criminalization. So I think we need to pursue marijuana legalization, but I think we also need to be much more upfront about saying this should be true for all drugs. And that doesn't mean all drugs should be treated exactly the same way. Maybe for opioids, you have to see a doctor and you get a prescription and you go to a pharmacy and they give you, whatever. In other places, it could be a commercial operation like it is with marijuana. So I think a lot of Americans understand that the drug war is not working. The opioid crisis, I think, has really opened a lot of people's eyes to this in places where they weren't really forced to think about this. Mm-hmm. And I think we got to go with that. We can't just talk to those people about marijuana. We got to talk to them about opioids and methamphetamines as well. Same sort of situation, because their kids are dying, and the policing is not helping.
Right, absolutely.
And they can't get services, mm-hmm. right? And they see that the situation is out of control. And someone just needs to come and really make the argument. We need a complete rethink on this.
I hear that. I live in a relatively rural part of Missouri, about two hours outside of St. Louis. It's deep, deep Trump country, flags in yards, Trump flags in yards. When I get on the freeway and I drive into St. Louis for work, I see billboards with pictures of white men in their 40s saying, don't kill yourself. There's hope. I see signs about, if your family members having problems with opioids, call us. Like there's, and I see it in the community when I go to the local Walmart. I see the desperation on the faces of these people. What do you see? Do you see anybody taking up the mantle and doing what you're suggesting, that are really reaching out to this community and trying to? Are you seeing that in the effort to end this drug war?
Well, there's a fantastic new book called "This Is Ohio" by Jack Shuler, who is from that part of the country, and he went and looked at, what's really happening in rural Ohio, which I think is a pretty fair analogy for rural Missouri.
Absolutely.
And so he was looking at the front lines of folks who've been affected by the drug war and are trying to chart a new path through harm reduction, public health, and getting the police out of this. It's a tremendous book. I think it's just recently come out, and I highly recommend it. So there are voices. There are folks at the Drug Policy Alliance who are also trying to reframe this conversation. And there's a whole harm reduction community rooted in public health practice. Leo Beletsky at Northeastern is doing tremendous work as just one example. So we need to plug into those folks who are really on the ground, groups like Vocal New York, that works with folks who have been drug involved and are really speaking from experience about what a failure using police has been.
And so I think there's definitely hope. I see the pieces of the puzzle are there, and we have ideas, and I really hope it comes together. Another thing that really affects my community and communities around the country is another type of leading to these deaths of despair is the mental health crisis, all of this, the stress and pressure. Now we have this COVID and the election and the social tensions, and a lot of people are ending up in crisis. And I've watched hundreds of police videos for my research. I investigate the use of deadly force and read thousands of accounts. And having someone who's done the job, I see a lot of these people in these shootings are in crisis. They're dealing with a mental health crisis, and it ends up with them being killed. And if we were to improve the mental health condition of our society and provide people with services, I believe we could reduce a lot of these officer-involved fatalities, these police killings. What do you envision in terms of this transition? We talked a little bit about the drugs, of easing off of the policing and onto the treatment and treating like a public health issue. How do you see it playing out in mental health? What does that look like? Do we stop sending to police? Are we sending them with other people? How does it look to you?
So, you know, we don't have great statistics on this, but it looks like between a quarter and a half of all people killed by police in the U.S. are having a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. And it's become a big part of the job. Estimates are around 15% of officers' day every day is spent, you know, dealing with these kinds of calls. So it's a huge part of what police do.
Absolutely.
And COVID has taught us one thing, which is the complete inadequacy of our public health systems in the United States. The inability to get testing up and running, contact tracing, good public health messaging, adequate health care services for people. I mean, this is all badly broken. So the best solutions have two main components. They have a component that is about building up community-based mental health services in general. And then the second is creating alternative crisis response infrastructures. So it's not enough to just say, oh, we're going to send a social worker instead of a cop. We've got to reduce the number of crisis calls in the first place, which is how, you know, in Europe, for the most part, people have access to free, decent, quality health care. And so you just don't have that many crisis calls.
Absolutely.
And when you do get one, you mostly get a non-police response. And in a place like the UK, because they have a single national healthcare system, when there's either a clinical response or a police response, they have access to the medical record. So there's, if you go to the police response room in the UK, and I've sat in there, there's a nurse from the National Health Service in the police dispatch room who has access to the National Health Service database, so that the responding officers can be told, okay, this is someone with a history of schizophrenia, this is the medication they're on, this is the responsible person in the home, this is the name of the physician, so that they know what they're getting into. And is it just that they didn't take their meds? They can try to talk this situation down more effectively. And that's we got to do that here. And a number of cities are looking at this: Albuquerque, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Austin. They're all now trying to figure this out, and I think it's tremendously important.
And can you talk a little bit about what happens when the police do respond? So we're talking about shifting to something else. Do you feel so people that are in crisis and then the police arrive, what can that bring into the situation that maybe wasn't there before? Or can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we've known this for a long time, right? You've read Egon Bittner's work. He's in the 60s. He said, look, there's basically three things police can do. They can force someone to a hospital, either legally or they can cajole them to a hospital. They can make an arrest, or they can try to stabilize the situation and just leave it alone. Mm-hmm. But none of those actually produce particularly good outcomes, right? So even if there's no violence, there's no arrest, that person is still not connected to stable healthcare services that they need. And how many times do the police just get called back over and over and over again with the same three bad choices in front of them? And then, of course, in some cases, and it's a pretty small percentage, but in some cases, these situations get out of hand. And unfortunately, in part, because it's a police officer. Because people don't want to get arrested or get forced into a hospital. And they identify the officer with those powers. And so they become reactive and defensive. And then, of course, in a place like the UK, where there's almost never an armed response because most police aren't even armed there, they have no such thing as suicide by cop.
Right.
And a lot of the police killings, this 15 to 20 or this 25 to 50%, you know, they're legally justified because the officer's confronting someone with a weapon. But could they have been completely avoided if we hadn't sent an armed officer to the home of someone who knew that someone with a gun was coming and all they had to do was pull out a fake gun and the officers would kill them?
So you can you envision a day, because there's the big one of the things I think is a major social problem in the United States is just the proliferation of guns. There's just guns. There are guns everywhere. I know I had Canadian friends who were police officers while I was a police officer, and I would have conversations with them, and I every day pointed my gun at somebody at work on a high risk vehicle stops, pulling people out of cars in the community I worked. It was part of my everyday life, and I encountered guns every shift, multiple times a day. I was encountering guns in the vehicles. Jesus. And I was scared. Like, it's one of my friends is a sociologist, actually called me the P word the other day almost for trying to explain, because they can't get the, I think people a lot of times have a time, I think a lot of times people have a difficult time understanding the lived experience of police officers, and they as well are scared of guns. They probably wouldn't frame it the way I'm framing it. But do you feel as though that the problems we're seeing with policing and the police violence that we're seeing is related to the Second Amendment and the proliferation of firearms in our country in any way? Or do you feel as though that could help solve the problem?
Well, it certainly doesn't help, right? I mean, it doesn't help in so many ways. I mean, look at these shootings at protests that are happening now in Portland and Kenosha. I mean, we've created a dynamic, and it's not new. I mean, this is at the core of American history, right? Where we've sort of privatized security and empowered people to carry out violence. And it's not going to be easy to break that cycle. You know, we could have a complete ban on new gun purchases tomorrow, and there would still be more guns and people in the United States. My feeling is we need supply side strategies. I'm sorry, we don't need more supply side strategies. We need demand side strategies. And by that, I mean, we're not going to fix this with gun control legislation and tougher enforcement of gun laws. I mean, I'm not exactly against these things. I think there are too many guns. I just don't think this is going to work. And we have another approach available, which is a demand side approach. Why are people carrying all these guns?
Mm-hmm. They're terrified.
Well, mostly they're afraid. Mostly they're afraid. But now some of their fears are misplaced, are racist, or whatever. You know, they think they're warding off government tyranny or something. I love how the people who defend the Second Amendment because they want to ward off government tyranny say that police should kill anyone who looks at them sideways and doesn't do exactly what the police tell them to do.
Yeah, this is, right? I have a strange argument all day. Yes,
all the time. All right. So why are young people in high crime neighborhoods picking up guns? Why are people on rural highways carrying guns? Right, where there's no real threat of violence to them, except from other people carrying guns who shouldn't be carrying guns, who have no real good reason for carrying them. So we do need to start addressing the political motivations and the fears and trying to break that cycle of gun carrying. Because, you know, in Canada, there are a lot of guns. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of guns, and nobody ever shoots anybody. Guns are used for hunting. You know, there are restrictions on handguns and assault weapons, but you know, a lot of Canada is very rural. A lot of people have guns, and they just never shoot one another. And therefore, the police don't worry about when they make a vehicle stop and someone has a gun rack with a bunch of rifles, because they just know that that's not going to be a threat to them, because not everyone is on pins and needles about, oh, my God, I need to be ready to shoot someone. I'll just say one other little thing to think about, which is in the UK and other parts of Europe where officers don't carry guns and they make a vehicle stop, the officers are not really worried about being shot, not just because there aren't that many guns in circulation, but because the driver really has no incentive to shoot the officer. If push comes to shove, they can just get away.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually safer for the officer because everyone knows the officer is not armed. So there's really no need to shoot them.
Right.
Something to think about.
Absolutely. And this is something we do see when the police are putting pressure on someone, when they're chasing them in pursuits. This is when a lot of these types of things happen. I would also argue that banning pursuits without unless they're extremely...
Except for extreme circumstances.
Right.
Absolutely. All the research shows that this is an incredibly dangerous undertaking that has very little payoff.
And if you look at like the numbers, we think, you know, a little over 1,000 people are shot and killed by the police every year. But if you look at how many people die during police encounters, it's closer to 2,000. And a significant portion of those are instances where people are attempting to flee from the police and either they are killed or they end up T-boning some person on the way to work, which, and I've seen that happen myself, and it is something that was caused by the policy. It's the caused by the higher up. It's not an individual level problem.
It's dangerous to police, right? I mean, traffic accidents are a major source of injury and death for police officers. And they're not all in high-speed chases, but a lot of them are.
Yeah, a friend of mine got hit by a drunk driver at work and killed. And I knew several other officers that were killed at work. I think this is a great opportunity to talk about something which I don't hear a lot of people talking about when they talk about relieving police of some of their primary functions as they are today, and that's the traffic control function. So mm-hmm. I see... a really depleted, almost non-existent public transportation system in the United States, which means that people need to, you know, have access to a vehicle if they want to get to work. Taking the bus is hard in America, and a lot of places. And the way our society is structured, those people typically have vehicles that are in states of disrepair. They have equipment problems, and they're exposed to a disproportionate number of traffic stops. There's also a lot of evidence that there's a racial bias at work in traffic stops and these pretextual stops where police officers are using the traffic control function. I know when I was a police officer, every day when I had free time, I went out, I looked for cars with traffic violations that I thought were good cars. In my head, mm-hmm. whatever this, which I think I made a constant effort to try to counter my bias. I think most people don't really do, but I know it was there. And I was stopping people, and then I would find for traffic violations, easy to find. And then I'm smelling the odor of cannabis at the time. I could find my way in the vehicle, and it was a digging expedition. And I was looking for guns, I was looking for dope, I was looking for people with warrants. And it creates these unpredictable encounters between police and citizens. It appears that there strong evidence to suggest they're racialized. And given this environment, these are like powder kegs. What are some of the ways that we could relieve the police of the traffic control function, in your opinion, or is that possible?
I think it's possible. I mean, Berkeley has recently made a decision to try to do this. Some other cities are looking at it. I had a call earlier today with an elected official in New York who's looking into trying to figure out how to do this. So this is a live issue. And I think it's great. It's not something that I had written about previously. It's not in the book. It's something I hadn't really thought deeply about, although I was aware of the problem of pretextual stops, which I do talk about in the drugs chapter. But I think this is tremendously important. We have more and more research all the time that shows these stops are not producing either road safety or preventing people from getting drugs or from carrying guns. So it's not working. It poses a lot of hazards and secondary problems. So what do we do? I mean, I think there's some room for using some electronic methods. There is evidence that, you know, red light cameras and speed cameras do actually help improve traffic behavior. But stopping people on the highway doesn't, just doesn't. And it's mostly done for revenue purposes and for fishing expeditions.
Yes.
And so we could create a civilian road safety kind of infrastructure that responds to crashes, takes reports, analyzes traffic safety data, could even potentially make some stops, but without arrest powers, without being armed, and just, you know, writing tickets for people. And if someone, you know, is willing to use force to escape that, then, you know, we have their license plate number. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do?
Right.
You know, we'll find them. And so we have these traffic agents in New York that direct traffic and can write certain kinds of moving violation summonses, but they don't have arrest powers. They're not armed. And we could just incrementally expand the number of things they do and take those things away from armed police.
And so when I hear this future sort of shaping up, which I think it's inevitable, it's something that's necessary. I don't think that the way policing is structured today is something I don't think it's feasible in this day and age anymore. I don't think it's going to work anymore. I think the change is coming. And we're going to be introducing new people into, and maybe even developing new structures to manage social problems or expanding existing. And there may be more people going out and making contact with the community, and there will be an element of risk involved. Do you feel as though that's something that as society we're going to need to sort of come to terms with and say that we're going to need people who are willing to go out into the community and take on a certain level of risk and treat this as like a community service sort of project? And how would, can you just talk a little bit if that makes any sense to you?
Sure. Well, let's think about these violence interruption program, these community-based anti-violence initiatives that use what we've sometimes referred to as credible messengers. Mm-hmm. So they're hiring people from. These should not be just done on a volunteer basis, although it often is, has been for years. A lot of people doing this on their own dime. But we should hire people from the community who are known in the community and known by the young people. They're credible, right? They have respect in the community to go and work with these young people to try to break the cycle of violence, because we know it's a fairly small population of young people at risk for involvement in violence as both victims and offenders. Mm-hmm. And we know that a lot of this is about beefs. You know, it's not about organized drug gangs doing assassinations. That's not what's driving the violence, mm-hmm. right? It's
retaliatory.
Now, some of them may be carrying guns because of their involvement in black markets, or that may be why guns are in heavy circulation. That's who's bringing them in, right? So if we reduce the drug war, got rid of the drug war, that would help reduce the guns right. in the community, I think, a lot. But we need people to go out and interact with those young people. And these credible messengers don't get shot, because everyone knows that they're not going to shoot back. They're not going to try to arrest anyone. They're just trying to talk to people.
Right.
So that even if you're like, nah, I don't want to have anything to do with you, get away from me, they're not going to be shot for their efforts.
Right.
Now, this is not to say there's no risk, you know, if we send more clinical and social workers on mental health crisis calls. Will some of them go bad? Yes. There will be risks, just as there are risks today to police officers and family, right? And no system is going to be perfect. There's no magic approach that's going to eliminate all harms. So we're just trying to make it better than what we have now without all the negative collateral consequences of intensive and punitive policing, mass incarceration, et cetera.
And the wonderful thing is I think that, because you said there will be an element of risk, but as I think that there are a lot of young people of all ages, but especially young people who would be willing to take on that risk to serve their community. There are a lot of people, the idea that the government would pay them a salary to go work and improve their community and enrich the lives of the people they love and care about, that's a fantasy for tons of people. They would be willing to take on a lot of risk. And I think you're right that it wouldn't be anywhere near as dangerous as we might think it is.
or as policing is, which they do end up going into.
Absolutely.
Let me just tell you a quick story about, I gave a talk in Houston a while back when we could still travel, and some former police officers, black and brown police officers, came to the talk, and they asked a question about changing police culture. They thought that maybe they could make the community better by getting a good job in policing, earning some money, and trying to change the culture of policing so it wasn't so racist and abusive, because that's how they had experienced it growing up. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't think there's a lot to be done about police culture. I think we just need to reduce the impact of policing and replace it with other things. And they came afterwards, and we talked for a while afterwards, and they were still trying to figure out what it was I was arguing for. And I said, look, when you were thinking about going into policing, if there had been the option of a job with the same pay and benefits, working in a community center with young people, coaching football and mentoring them, which job would you have chosen? And they all laughed. And, oh, man, we would have loved a job, you know, in a community center with kids in our own neighborhood. But there were no such jobs. And I'm like, exactly. Why are there never those jobs? Mm-hmm. But the police department is always hiring.
It's not valued. I recently had an experience. I'm sorry to tell you a story, but I recently had experience where we were trying to work on a violence reduction program. We had money to pay police officers to go and engage in activities in the community, play basketball with the police athletic league, to coach dance, art, whatever an officer would be interested in doing. We wanted to create non-enforcement environments where people could spend time together. And the department was incapable of accepting the funds. They didn't have the infrastructure in place to give money to police officers to do that. They couldn't manage it, and they also were reluctant to accept that was something that an officer should be paid for. And not just the police department, but also members of the community felt as though the type of officers they wanted doing that were the type of officers that were doing it for free. And when you frame it that way, it's as if it's some extra thing that police officers, or as a society, we should be doing. I would argue it shouldn't be police officers that are doing a lot of that work.
Well, that's the thing, right? That's really the issue. Why not have dance teachers teach dance?
Sure. Yeah, I was dealing with the hand I had. I had the government saying, "Here's money and spend it to make you know." Yeah. So I'm like, "Well, let's."
But when we embedded in specialized courts and probation programs and police athletic leads, then it comes with all this baggage that undermines its acceptance among the young people who you're trying to reach.
Absolutely, and yeah, it was. Discouraging, to say the least. Can you talk a little bit? I'm gonna let you go here. I know you have another meeting coming up. I just wanted to leave it with you here in the end and give you a chance to just, because we all, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, but I think about my utopia. I think about what kind of a society would I like my great great grandchildren to live in. If as a human being, what type of a world would I like to live in? And this is not, this is, there's a lot of problems. This is not, and the way I, and policing is a symptom and a symbol of a lot of these problems. What in the future, when we've solved these problems, I'm assuming there will always be a need for some type of consolidation of the use of violence by the state to, you know, because there'll be people who are on a margin even once we've brought those there's always going to be some kind of function. Are you seeing a force that exists that's very disconnected from all of the, like, what does it look like in your future, in your society? What does policing look like?
So I don't have some sort of pre-worked out vision here. I mean, I have some principles and I have some ideals and stuff that help guide my thinking about this. I mean, I think we need to try to solve problems in ways that work, that are efficient, and that treat people with as much human dignity as possible. So these are like kind of core principles that guide my thinking about this. And I would like to live in a world where we don't solve problems through the use of violence, of putting human beings into cages and things like that. I mean, I think that most people want to live in a world like that. Now, I don't have some like 6-point formula about how we get there. I mean, these are big questions, and I don't want to pretend that there's some magic formula and that I've got it all figured out, because I don't. I think what we do is we take some principles and we start trying to enact them. So what do we get at the end of that? Is there still some need for violence workers, which is, you know, what distinguishes police from other parts of government? It's possible. You know, there may be people who will try to take advantage, who will, you know, there will always be people who commit harms. You know, I think a lot of that can be dealt with in better ways than just through arrest and incarceration, which is not very effective and hugely expensive and blah, blah, blah. So it's possible that there will be some residue of violence workers that's needed, but it would be so limited in scope. And I think it would need to be very tightly regulated, because when you give people guns and legal authority, it's a recipe for potential problems. We just see this all over the world. And so, you know, you look at maybe the armed response units in the UK, which is not, I'm not holding that up as an ideal model, but only a certain small number of officers are allowed to use weapons under very limited circumstances with very tight oversight and supervision. And any use of violence like that, anytime there's a police shooting in the UK, it's treated almost like an airline disaster, which is that there's immediately a sense in which something has failed.
Mm-hmm. System failure.
And it's not just about pointing blame at some one individual. It's like, how did we end up in this mess where that seemed like that was the only way to go? That was the best alternative And it's not usually about a training problem or a bias problem, right? It's like, well, where were the mental health infrastructures in place? This young person who was shot had 6 previous encounters with the criminal justice system, and his issues were never addressed effectively. And so the problem just kept getting. So where was the intervention when that first arrest happened to divert them into something, you know, just as examples, right? So a smaller, very highly regulated body, possibly.
And one final small follow-up question.
Yeah.
It's hard to let you go. I'm enjoying this conversation, but I promise. Last one is, when you look around right now and you see where we are and what's happening, and you compare it to a year ago, do you feel as though we're further along to something that you envision, or do you worry that maybe this what's happening is going to make this more difficult to accomplish? Are you optimistic, or how are you feeling right now with all
how
this?
Am I feeling?
Yeah, with what's going on? And
sleep deprived.
Yeah.
So, you know, the situation in Washington is just such a mess. And if we had to fix the problem there, I think I would be pretty pessimistic. But, you know, these are mostly local questions. These are local budget questions. This is, people are showing up at city council budget hearings. And I think there's a lot we can win there. I think there's a lot we can fix. And maybe we can create a new logic and a set of models and examples that will percolate up to the federal stage, to statewide stages. So, I spent the last 3 years before COVID traveling every other week around the country in dozens of cities. And this is a real movement. It was happening long before Minneapolis. And people are winning things and shifting the logic. But it's going to be very hard. I mean, the big center of American politics, such as it is still thinks we can fix this with implicit bias training and community policing.
Right.
And so we have a lot of work to do to disabuse them of that idea and to demand real racial and economic justice. And policing is not going to be at the center of that.
Okay, well, I think that's the perfect place to end this. I want to thank you again, Professor, for your time and energy. I know you're a busy person, and we have police officers that listen to this. We have so it's a great opportunity for you to reach out and maybe access an audience that you don't have did a lot of access to. So, but I don't know. I just gave myself a compliment, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, thank you very much. I really appreciate it, and have a great day. And I'll put your link to your book, your faculty page. Is there any other places where people should reach out to if they want to contact your follow your content?
Well, I have my personal page, you know, alex-vitali.info, and then there the Policing and Social Justice Project, where we have some reports and link to work we're doing is also available. Yeah,
great. Thank you very much again, and I'll add those
you
links.
Bet thanks so